This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we're going to talk about a new law that recently went into effect aimed at increasing law enforcement transparency in California.
Taxpayer-funded organizations need to be clear with the public about how they conduct themselves.
And later in the program, Father Ian returns with Playing with Food and talks Passover.
You know, before everybody could read and write, I think the Seder plate was used to help people remember the symbols of the Exodus.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 25th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Media outlets across the state have joined together for what's being called the California Reporting Project. At the beginning of 2019, law enforcement personnel records became a matter of public record. News organizations, including KCBX, have been collaborating to obtain the records from police agencies and share findings. But not all departments have been quick to hand over information. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart with more.
After the new police records transparency law took effect, KCBX News filed public records requests, or PRAs, with five Central Coast law enforcement agencies, the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Office and District Attorney's Office, and the police departments in Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Maria. The newsroom asked for personnel records ranging from 2014 to 2018 for officers found to have committed sexual assault, use force which caused great bodily injury or death, or engaged in dishonesty-related conduct. As of March 21st, KCBX News has received documents from just one of those agencies, the San Luis Obispo Police Department. KCBX's Tyler Pratt has more.
The San Luis Obispo Police Department gave KCBX News 23 documents dating back to 1992, primarily related to the cases of four former officers. These included one who attempted to illegally bring pills across the Mexican border and another arrested for extortion. According to the department, no officers were accused of sexual misconduct or extreme use of force, and SLO PD made all the records publicly available online. The Paso Robles Police Department says they have no relevant records. KCBX News asked why there are none relating to the investigation of Christopher McGuire. He's the former Paso Robles police officer accused of alleged rape and abuse of power. Those allegations were detailed in a SLO County Sheriff's report leaked to the San Luis Obispo Tribune. A spokesperson for the Paso Robles PD says McGuire resigned before the city could complete an internal investigation, and then they closed it. The San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Office says they did find documents relating to officer misconduct and one where use of force caused a death. However, the Sheriff's Office says it could take 6 months to deliver them. Tyler Pratt, KCBX News.
The Santa Maria Police Department responded 2 weeks after KCBX's request, saying that it has records, but it needs time to gather them. No delivery date has been given. Santa Maria Assistant City Attorney Jeffrey Patrick says the city takes the public's right to transparency seriously and regrets the delays. He said they are caused by short staffing and because these kind of documents have never been asked for before by the public. The San Luis Obispo County District Attorney's Office says they also have documents related to the new transparency law, but have asked for multiple extensions to deliver them. Assistant DA Eric Doberth told KCBX News he knew of at least one case of a dishonesty-related conduct by an investigator with the DA's office. But as of Thursday, the SLO County DA's office has not provided this or any other records. Stay tuned as we continue to report on the findings as they become available over the coming weeks. With KCBX News, I'm Greta Mart.
You're tuned to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. To continue diving into how SB 1421 impacts law enforcement transparency, KCBX News recently spoke with two reporters from the San Luis Obispo Tribune who have been covering a story about the Paso Robles Police Department and several other Central Coast law enforcement agencies. It involves the officer at the Paso Robles Police Department that we mentioned earlier, accused of alleged rape and abuse of power while on the job. Also, a leaked document Department and agencies who refused to share information about the case. The Tribune recently joined up with another media outlet, KSBY, and local lawmakers to try and change some of the law's language and eliminate some possible loopholes. So to unpack all of this, I was recently joined in the KCBX studios by Tribune reporters Matt Fountain and Lindsay Holden, who cover the courts and North San Luis Obispo County, respectively, to unpack this story.
So me and Matt have been kind of doing this together, and basically Christopher McGuire, a former sergeant for the Paso Robles Police Department, has been accused by three women of inappropriate behavior in various levels. There's one woman who accused him of raping her. There's another woman who said they had a consensual relationship, but all of their activity occurred while he was on duty, some of which actually occurred in his police car. And then a third woman basically said he asked her to, you know, flash him when she was being arrested. So that, and then he was under investigation by the Paso Robles Police Department. He was put on administrative leave. And then the sheriff's office also did an investigation, but the district attorney's office declined to charge him.
Now, the sequence here has been tricky. Kind of walk me through how all this came to light. He was being investigated by the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Office, and then the SLO Sheriff, and then Paso. So we've got a lot of agencies in here all looking at this guy, right?
Yeah. So one of the victims actually reported her alleged rape to the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Department. And then they told the Paso Robles Police Department about her allegations, and that kind of kicked off the whole investigation.
Tell me a little bit about your reporting and what you were hearing from the different agencies that you were speaking with.
Sure. So we kind of caught wind of the alleged actions of this officer in regards to another criminal case that was going on unrelated in the San Luis Obispo Superior Court, and how the attorney in that case was looking to request his personnel records as part of that case, as part of impeachable material, should that officer ever be brought in the stand in this case. Christopher McGuire had an investigatory role in this separate case. So we had heard rumblings that there was an officer who had serial misconduct allegations against him. Eventually, I believe KSBY broke the initial story about that while we were still investigating it. And once news came out about that, he might have already been on leave. This was back in May of last year when the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office contacted Paso Robles. Paso Robles immediately contacted the Sheriff's Office to kick off their investigation. And that's when we were able to verify that this officer was in fact under investigation. They wouldn't exactly say what at first. Paso Robles just called it a very serious criminal act and that he had tarnished the badge somehow. So he went off on paid administrative leave while the sheriff's office continued their investigation. During that time, we just basically kind of canvassed talking to everybody and anybody we could from Paso Robles. There's an interested party of residents up there who claim that they've been harassed by this officer. Typically, these are not the kind of people that would be reporting to police or the kind of people who feel comfortable talking to police. These are the kind of people that he was accused of taking advantage of.
And the details of this story, it can be graphic at times. And so we won't go into it on air for any sensitive listeners out there, but it is all available on the San Luis Obispo Tribune website. And the reporting you guys have done on this has been fantastic.
Thank you.
And so then the SLO district attorney decided to not press charges, even though McGuire's DNA was found at the alleged crime scene. There's GPS data and dozens of witnesses.
That's correct. There seemed to be, reading the portion of the sheriff's office report that we obtained, it should be said also the sheriff's office detective who was assigned to the case recommended that the DA's office charge him with forcible rape and a whole list of other heinous sexual crimes. And despite that finding, the DA's office took that information, took about 2 months to do their own investigation before deciding that they didn't have enough to prosecute him beyond a reasonable doubt, which is, of course, their burden of proof. But also, they say it's unethical for them to bring something forward in a court of law that they don't believe that they can win. So in that 2 months that it took for the DA's office to make that decision, 1 month into it, the officer resigned. So he's gone. The DA's office decides not to file, and that's the end of the story.
What did you gauge from this press conference, Lindsay?
Well, they said they weren't going to charge him. And then I think I asked the sheriff's office recommended charges, which they hadn't announced before. And he said that they had. And he basically said, I think he said, like, no reasonable or objective jury would be able to find the officer guilty.
Okay, so let's jump forward just a little bit. In January, SB 1421 goes into effect, and media outlets across the state, as I mentioned earlier, many working together, many working individually, start sending public information requests to agencies, as I'm sure you did to all of these. And so what did you get back, or what are you hearing from the law enforcement agencies that you spoke with?
So before SB 21 took effect in January, California had it was one of the strictest states as far as withholding confidential personnel records of officers accused of stuff. Officers enjoyed a variety of protections that even other public employees didn't. SB 1421 really changed that. Basically, what SB 1421 is doing is making open records for which there is a quote-unquote sustained finding by the appropriate agency, which sometimes becomes a boondoggle in itself, of an officer who is accused of dishonesty or accused of a sexual misconduct of any kind of sort. And if there is a sustained finding, which basically means a agency confirms that, yes, in fact, there is at least probable cause that this happened, that makes those records open to the public to gauge to see how the department handled that particular case, and also just to know which officer who might still be around has these kind of allegations against them. So we, in this case, we of course filed everything under the sun that we could, even prior to January, on, you know, from the county sheriff's office, DA's office, and from the city of Paso Robles. What we were told is basically, you know, you're not able to get these records, and because there was no sustained finding in McGuire's case, none of those records would be open to us even after this bill takes effect. So the reason that they're saying that there is no sustained finding was kind of the way that this whole thing went down, that he was placed on administrative leave while the sheriff's office did their investigation. Paso Robles police chief says that they immediately, you know, handed everything over to the sheriff's office. They did not start an internal city investigation I'm not sure if it's like you call it a professional courtesy or if they didn't logistically want to step on the toes of the investigators who were going to be investigating the same stuff. But essentially what that allowed McGuire to do is to squeak out quietly, because the sheriff's office made this finding that there should be charges pressed, and they forwarded the county agency, and then they forwarded that to the other county agency, the DA's office. DA's office said, well, we can't prosecute. So that's basically the equivalent of no sustained finding from the county's perspective. Now, you go back to the city. He had already resigned before the DA's office had finished, you know, had made their play. So the city of Paso Robles never actually started investigating this guy, never started, you know, verifying things. So if he had been found in an internal investigation to have violated, you know, maybe not criminal, but administrative things, there would be a sustained finding for us to seek these records. But because he was able to resign, not necessarily allowed to resign by the city, he has due process rights. But because the way it all went down, resigned before the city could make any sustained finding, after the county could not make a sustained finding, he's on basically free and clear for records transparency.
And that's what we heard from Paso Robles as well, is that as soon as he resigned, they closed the case, essentially.
Yes, I think the words that the chief used was there was nobody to investigate, no employee to longer investigate in this case.
And then just to clarify what you just went through, if the sheriff's office recommended charges were not handed down by the district attorney, when you requested those documents from the sheriff's office, you did not get anything back from the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Office?
No, to this day.
So your paper has partnered with another media outlet and is working with lawmakers to help change some of the language of SB 1421 to help possibly remove these loopholes. Can one of you speak on that?
Sure. Yes. We're basically at the point right now where we're still gathering. We did a lot of public records requests to basically every local agency. We are compiling those right now, and we're going to be sharing those with every other media outlet who's participating in this project in California. The idea is to get a really large picture of what's going on in the state, what's been going on, and how we can make it better as far as accountability for, as I like to call them, bad apples, you know, in the department.
And this project is called the California Reporting Project. KCBX is a member, as are media outlets across the state. And being a journalist here in California, it's been pretty cool to see all of these agencies working together with one goal in mind.
For years, we've been waiting for something like this to come along.
Less competition and more collaborative, which this industry needs.
Yeah, and I will say, like, Matt has done more work with this, but I will say SB 1421 is super important. I mean, in the past, we've just really been stonewalled in terms of getting information about police officers. Like, previous stories I've worked on, it's just been challenging to get information about, you know, police officers that we're looking into. And so hopefully this will make that easier.
What would you like to happen in this next legislative session?
Well, our Central Coast Assemblyman Jordan Cunningham we sat down with him 2 weeks ago to talk about this, and he agrees that there needs to be strengthening of this law. He's said that he is going to sit down and speak with State Senator Nancy Skinner, the author of SB 1421. And it should be noted that Jordan Cunningham voted for the House version of that bill, and is a strong advocate for police transparency. He's a former prosecutor and a current defense attorney. It's all kind of up in the air at this point. We don't have any concrete idea of what, you know, that looks like strengthening that. It should be said that this McGuire case has directly led to Assemblyman Cunningham submitting another assembly bill, which I highly doubt he's any more privy than we are into District Attorney Dan Dow's thinking as to why specifically our District Attorney's office could not charge McGuire. But with Jordan's legal background, he, you know, helped draft this AB 1599, which will make it a criminal violation for a public official to use their position of power and authority for sexual gratification, sexual favors, even in some cases, if I'm reading this bill correctly, where there is a consensual issue, such as the McGuire case, because he was having an ongoing consensual relationship with a woman while on duty, who he met while on duty, using his police car, and all that was apparently verified in the sheriff's office report. And so this AB 1599 sounds to me, again, I'm not a lawyer, that it would have at least given Dan Dow, in the case of McGuire, something to charge instead of absolutely nothing when there is a host of things, just, you know, using a police car for non-police, you know, activities. It seems like there should be some kind of something there. So Cunningham's bill aims to basically give prosecutors something to be able to charge public officials who abuse their authority for sex.
And Matt, you're in the courts a lot. Have you spoke with Dan Dow about this following their decision to not prosecute?
I have. I have conversation with him almost every day about various different things. And, you know, he take him at his word that he takes this very seriously. And he is a firm believer, and he says it again and again, that he, you know, it's his duty not to take something to court unless he has a very, you know, very strong conviction that he can get a conviction.
So I have to ask you both, what's next for this McGuire story?
We're not really sure. I'm trying to verify where he is. Obviously, the Tribune has kind of taken on certain stories. We reported on former Napomo High School wrestling coach who was given a non-disclosure agreement after horrible allegations of him, his activities, and he basically got this sweetheart deal with the district for them not to disclose any of the allegations against him, just verify, you know, that he was there when he was there, and then so he can go on to another district. We're pretty concerned with passing along bad apples, as they call them. So we want to make sure that this officer, who may have dodged some very serious criminal charges or some kind of discipline, that he's not just shuffled off to another district so he does this again to somebody else. And so that's kind of our task going forward, to find out where he's at right now. And then we're also still hopeful that we can still get his records. We believe that in the I don't want to speak for our attorneys, but our legal counsel seems to believe pretty strongly that the sheriff's office recommendation does in fact constitute a sustained finding. So we're going to keep that fight up and we're going to keep pushing for those records. Whether or not we get anything more on former Sergeant McGuire, not sure, but we are going to be continuing to keep our eyes on police departments all over our county.
As a journalist, transparency from public agencies is so important. You know, whether it's a school district, whether it's a police department, taxpayer-funded organizations need to be clear with the public about how they conduct themselves.
Lindsay Holden, Matt Fountain with the San Luis Obispo Tribune. Thank you so much for stopping by today. We look forward to seeing more of your reporting.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for having us.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Next up on Issues and Ideas, we talk wine. We invited the new leader of the San Luis Obispo Wine Association into the studio to talk about member wineries and marketing wines made in the Edna Valley and Arroyo Grande to other parts of the country and the world. Here's KCBX's Greta Mart with this interview.
I'm here in the KCBX studio with, may I ask you to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Ann Steinhauer, and I'm the new executive director for the San Luis Obispo Wine Association.
And so tell me about the association. How long has it been around? Who founded it? What do you guys do?
So we are an association of winery members from the Edna Valley and Arroyo Grande Valleys, and we have about 30 wineries that are members. And we focus on building up those appellations and the wineries so that people know that they can come and drink really great wine here in San Luis Obispo.
Okay, great. And are you able to name just like some of your members? Like, would people know these labels?
Absolutely. So they're very well-known names. Tolosa Winery, Edna Valley Vineyards, Aubrey Cellars, Wolf Cellars, Biddle Ranch. So those are some of the tally are some of the names.
Okay, right. And so what do you do on a day-to-day basis? What does your job consist of mostly?
I'm only on day 10.
Oh, okay.
So right now I'm getting to know the members better than I know them from before. And I'm focused on how do we help build their reputation, not only here in San Luis Obispo. For example, you told me that you hadn't even heard of us before. Mm-hmm. So how do we build our reputation both here in San Luis Obispo, but in the county, but then also globally? And so we're very focused on the new flyby markets that the airport's going to reach out to. And we're also looking at San Francisco Bay Area and the LA region to be able to bring people in, to be able to enjoy our beautiful lifestyle here, the slow life, stay in our fabulous hotels, eat in our wonderful restaurants, and come and drink some really amazing wines from the Edna Valley and the Arroyo Grande Valleys.
Okay. I see. Okay. So let more people in like the Bay Area know that instead of going to Napa for the weekend, they could come down here and that kind of thing.
Exactly. And we make really good wines anywhere from Albarino to Zinfandel. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are kind of our two top varieties. We have amazing growing conditions. We have incredible climate with the coast here within 5 miles of where we are farming. And you can drive within a quick 5-10 minute drive from downtown SLO to these areas and be able to see us in action. And a lot of our tasting rooms, the owners and the winemakers and the vineyard managers are on site doing the work. So when you walk in, you can actually see people in action.
Okay, got it. All right. And you said internationally. So does this mean, maybe you don't know this yet, but is your job going to involve like going to China or?
Sure hope so.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Not that I know of just of yet, but you know, the wine industry is a global wine industry. We all know that France is very engaged in this. We all know that there's a great growing region in South Africa, and being able to share our name and our wines into those areas is something I'd definitely be interested in learning how to do.
Okay, got it. All right. And you said flyby at the airport. What does that mean? I don't know what that means.
San Luis Obispo Airport has direct flights to certain cities, i.e. Washington, Arizona. And so if we can get some of those direct flights out to those areas and start sharing our wines, then we have an easier way of getting those consumers out here to be able to participate in the slow life and to be able to drink our wines.
I got it. All right. So in like we have a direct flight to Denver. So you would go and market in Denver.
Correct.
Trying to get people to say, oh, I'm going to fly to San Luis Obispo for the weekend and go wine tasting.
Correct.
I got it. Okay. All right. And what does the organization consist of and how long has it been around?
So we've been around for 30 years. Right now we have 30 wineries that are members, and those are brick and mortar wineries. We're also increasing membership opportunities for those that support the wine industry. So we have a grower category, and those are our vineyard managers. We have associate winemakers that might have vineyards here but don't have a brick and mortar winery. So there is an opportunity for them to be members as well. We put on two major events, including Roll Out the Barrels, which is on the Mission Plaza in downtown San Luis Obispo at the end of June. And then we do Harvest at the Coast, which is out in Avila, which is in November. And that's an event and live auction that specifically benefits our association, but also allows us to get the word out about our amazing, amazing wines. Most of our sales are direct to consumer, or DTC is what we call it in the industry. And that is, you know, you come in and you taste wine and then you purchase wine and take it home. And that is really our strongest sales point. We'd love to see our wines in more of the local restaurants and promoting that real farm to table atmosphere. And we'd love to participate in that as well. Just about all the wineries that are in Edna Valley and Aurora Grande Valley have got phenomenal tasting experiences. And you can literally sit out in the middle of the vineyards and drink a glass of wine, and you're not more than 10, 15 minutes from where you live.
Who did you take over for? Will we know?
I took over from Heather Murren, who is going to move on to work with the Wine History Project. And so you'll be seeing her name again. She is a fantastic person, and she did amazing work with this organization. And I'm very excited to take over from her.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Of course, anytime. Thank you very much.
That was Ann Steinhauer, Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo Wine Association, in the KCBX studio. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we're going to learn about hidden mines in San Luis Obispo County.
Mining, at least from what I can tell, was a really integral part of kind of what helped build this county up, especially in the case of like Cambria.
That's up later on Issues and Ideas here on KCBX. You're tuned to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. That Slow Weird is a series from the San Luis Obispo Tribune that dives into the weird and wonderful curiosities of San Luis Obispo County. Previous stories have included the history of the Big Pyramid on Higuera and the Roosters of Arroyo Grande. The reporter now at the helm of this series, Gabby Ferreira, who joins us in the KCBX studio. Hi, Gabby.
Hi, Tyler. How's it going?
Going good. Thank you. So for the latest installment in this series, old mercury mines sit abandoned across Slo County, and they are hiding in plain sight. Okay, Gabby, fill us in. What's going on?
All right. So this is something that I got interested in probably about a year ago. I had been doing some weather stories, and I had noticed, you know, like when you're doing a weather story, you want to update people on road closures and hazards and things like that so you don't drive into something crazy. And I had noticed that there was this road called Clow Mine. And I thought, a clow mine? So is that a mine of some kind? Is it just a place name? I've always been really interested in how things get their names. So I was talking to Andrew Sheeler, who used to do Slow Weird. And he mentioned, he's like, yeah, you know, there's like a ton of abandoned mines around here. And I used to live in Arizona, so I'm very familiar with like, you know, abandoned copper mines and things like that. So I thought, okay, this is really cool. I had no idea that this was even here. And so I started digging through our archives, and I found out, okay, it was mercury mines. So what does that entail? Because that's not, you know, that's not like a precious metal. So why were people mining for mercury? And so I discovered, you know, mercury was really important during the gold rush because basically they would put it on these plates so that they could extract gold and silver from their ores. And so it would like make amalgam of like mercury in the thing, and then they'd have to put it through something else to separate it again and get like the gold or the silver or the precious metals. So like people were using that during the gold rush. People would use that to get silver to pay for the Civil War. Later on, mercury was also used as an ingredient in munitions. So that's kind of really interesting to me, just kind of how this substance kept the wheels of America's economy turning. And it's not something that I really thought about in a modern day context other than, you know, like it's poisonous and don't touch it. And that's what used to go in thermometers.
Well, you mentioned in your article there are about 150 mercury mines across the county. How were these mines discovered? And they were looking for something called cinnabar. Is that correct?
Yes. So cinnabar is the ore that mercury comes from. It's like a reddish looking thing. And people had known that cinnabar existed for a really long time. The indigenous inhabitants of Slough County reportedly used it as paint. But people didn't really think about, like, okay, we can use cinnabar and it becomes mercury in this county, at least, until the 1860s. And so accounts kind of vary. But from what I understand, the first mercury mine that people really started mining was called variously the Josephine mine, the Little Bonanza mine. It was basically, it was a mine or a series of mines between Paso Robles and San Simeon. So in that area, that mountain range area.
I read in your article that one Slough mine established Cambria as a city.
Yes, that's correct. That was the Oceanic mine.
So diving into your article, you say a writer for the Tribune said too much encouragement cannot be given to this industry. What was the general attitude around mining back in the day?
So as far as I can tell from our archives, and you know, and keep in mind, when you're looking through historical documents, you really only have the perspective of the people who are writing them. So I can't get in a time machine and go to the 1870s and figure out how everybody thought about the mines, but at least in the Tribune's archives, we were a very pro-mine newspaper, very pro-mine. And actually, the writer that we think wrote that article, we believe it was O.F. Thornton, who was later an editor at the Tribune. He was super into mining, loved it. And I think he eventually ended up going to Tombstone, Arizona to try his luck.
Is mining one of the reasons that this county was formed and people moved out here? Was to
yes.
find mercury?
Yes, this was mining, at least from what I can tell, was a really integral part of kind of what helped build this county up, especially in the case of like Cambria.
The mining continued for upwards of a century. And as we know, society has learned about the environmental hazards of mining. You write about Las Tablas Creek turning orange in 1995, people describing it looking like tomato soup. What happened?
That's really interesting you bring that up. That was the Buena Vista mine. It was discharging this really nasty mercury drainage into Las Tablas Creek, which feeds into Lake Nacimiento. And the mine's owner, Harold Biagini, was basically, he didn't comment when that happened, but earlier he had said like, oh no, the creek just turns orange because there's cinnabar in the water and that's how that happens. But that was not the case. It was mercury runoff.
There were other reports of farmers finding mercury in their produce, correct?
Yes. So that was the Sharon Springs farm, which is up near Cambria, and reports as far as I can tell, and Melody Coe at the Cambria Historical Society told me that at least some of the Sharon Springs property is where the mine used to be. It's in that same general area. So there was a bit of a panic. Sharon Springs Farm sells organic produce. They were going to farmers markets. So people were really worried, like, okay, some of their produce has mercury in it. So what do we do? And the health department asked people who had eaten their produce to come in and, you know, and get tested and make sure that there wasn't any mercury in their system. And they found that no one was really affected by it. It was fine. But it was a little bit of a scare. And our records at the time, the health department's phone lines are just like, oh, they're so, you know, crowded with people scared that they might have ingested something.
Well, that leads me to a question I was going to ask you. Did you uncover any health problems in any residents or workers associated with Century of Mining?
Unfortunately, I was not able to dig into that. It was just a problem of a lot of these mines. The last ones stopped running in the 70s, and most of them stopped running before that. So unfortunately, a lot of the people that I would have loved to talk to are no longer here.
Okay. Now, you said the EPA has been involved in cleanup of some of these mine sites?
Yes. So Clow Mine and the Buena Vista Mine are both considered a Superfund site. Since they're adjacent, they're considered one Superfund site on the National Priorities List, which means that the EPA is actively engaged in the process of monitoring them and making sure that they're clean, you know, and that there's nothing really leaching into the environment that could hurt anybody or anything.
where could I find one of these mines now? Can I go visit one? Will I accidentally fall down a mine shaft somewhere in the county?
I don't want to encourage anybody to visit an abandoned mine just because there's a lot of
a multitude
hazards.
Of reasons.
Yes. So you got to remember, the last of these mines shut down in the late 60s, early 70s, and nobody has been maintaining these mines since that time. The EPA has been making sure that it's safe. But not a really good idea to go wandering around and, you know, accidentally falling down a mine shaft you can't see, or going into a tunnel and then like, oh no, there's a pocket of poisonous gas. If you do decide to go out that way, proceed with a lot of caution. A lot of these mine areas are private property, so just be safe. So in my story, which you can find at sanluisobispo.com, I do have a map that shows where those major mines are. They're basically kind of approximate locations. The Rinconada mine is accessible from the Rinconada hiking trail, which is out near Pozo. The Clow and Buena Vista mines are in the Adelaida area, if you're ever up that way. The Oceanic mine, like I said, is about 5 miles up Santa Rosa Creek from Cambria, so in that general area. All my locations are approximate based on what I can find from, you know, data that we have, accounts that we have. So I don't have like an exact street address for any of them, but, you know, they're in those general areas. One person who really helped me on this project was David Middlecamp, our staff photographer, who's incredibly knowledgeable about the history of San Luis Obispo County and took insanely good drone video of the Rinconada mine. So if you're like me and you're the world's biggest klutz and don't particularly want to try to traipse around an abandoned mine, I highly recommend watching that video. You can find it with my story at sanluisobispo.com.
Well, you dived back through the Tribune archives for a lot of your reporting on this, and this paper has really been documenting San Luis Obispo County since like 1869. What did you learn about our county? Anything else that you discovered while you were digging around in these archives?
So one of the things that I thought was super interesting that came out of this, I was reading about these accounts of people who would go to the mines to make social calls. You know, they go, there were families that lived out that way. So they go, you know, hang out, you know, have a picnic. That was really, seemed like it was more of a thing in the 20s and 30s. What's really funny is in the early part of the 20th century, the Tribune had kind of a society page where they had correspondents in the Rinconada area or Santa Margarita, or they had a correspondent up in the North County or wherever. They were usually women. They were identified by their husband's name. So, for example, Mrs. Bob Jones wasn't a name, but for an example. And these women would kind of write, here's what went on in the town. So, you know, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so took a picnic up this way and they had a great time. Or Mr. Jones came down from Salinas after a business trip. It was really nice to kind of explore and see more of that small town feel, just kind of, you know, seeing how people cared what their neighbors did or where they were going or what people were doing. And it was kind of our version of a society page, I think.
So are you milling around any ideas for the next installment of That Slow Weird series? Anything we can look forward to?
Yes, sir, I am. I'm working on it as we speak. And I am working on horse racing and automobile racing in San Luis Obispo.
Cool, cool. Can't wait to read it. Gabby Ferreira, reporter at the San Luis Obispo Tribune. Thanks so much for coming in, Gabby.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great work in mining into the history of Slow County's mines. We look forward to more That's Slow Weird in the San Luis Obispo Tribune. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Ilu, ilu, hotianu, hotianu, mimi, traim,
hotianu, mimi, traim, dienu. This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food. It's spring, and the Jewish festival of Passover is not far away. And with every Jewish festival, there is food. Central to this festival is the Seder plate.
Seder means order. And the idea behind a Seder is you sit with family and friends, and you tell the story of the Exodus, and you pray, and you thank God for freedom. We have traditional things on the Seder plates. We have parsley, which we dip in salt water, which symbolizes the tears of the slaves. A roasted lamb shank bone, which symbolizes the killing of the firstborn Egyptians. Horseradish, which is a bitter herb. Mm-hmm. An egg, which symbolizes new life and rebirth.
The unleavened bread symbolizes that the Israelites did not have time for the bread or to leaven or to rise.
That bread is called matzah, And one more item on the plate is Haroset. Robin Friedman O'Leary and Judy Harris showed me how to make this delicious, treat, mixture, condiment. Not sure what category it's in, but it's important to a Seder, and it's delicious. We also made matzah crackers, each of us for the first time. And I helped them reimagine what can be done with these delicious and symbolic foodstuffs. We are truly playing with food.
I'm Judy Harris. I'm an educator, now retired. Today I'm making Haroset.
I'm Robin Friedman O'Leary, and I'm the office administrator at Congregation Beth David and a longtime congregant. And today I'm making Ashkenazi Haroset.
Okay, mine is Sephardic, stemming from Spain, but today I'm making a Moroccan from Marrakesh Haroset. Mine is with dates, walnuts, and wine.
And mine is a more traditional Eastern European Haroset, which is just apples, walnuts, wine, and I use nutmeg. But some people use cinnamon, but I like to use a little nutmeg.
Haroset is how it's pronounced, and it is a Hebrew word meaning clay. When I grew up, we called it mud because it's very thick and binds together. It is spelled differently in the Sephardic, H-A-R-O-S-E-T.
And in Ashkenazi, it's Haroset with a C-H. But I think the difference there is that when you Americanize it, it's called Haroset. That's kind of the English version of it. And then Haroset would be a transliteration of the Hebrew for it.
So we've got this clay, we've got this mud. What is it for?
That's one of the symbols of Passover. We have bitter herbs, lamb shank, egg, parsley, and that's dipped in salt water. And then the mud or clay, representing the mortar of rebuilding the temple.
Oh, see, and I always was told that it represented the mortar that was used to build the pyramids in Egypt because it's the story of Exodus. But see, that's one of the interesting things about Judaism is because of the diaspora and because the Seder plate is a symbolic device. I think earlier it was a mnemonic device. You know, before everybody could read and write, I think the Seder plate was used to help people remember the symbols of the Exodus. And so that's probably where the differences come in. But it probably does stand for both when you think about it in the end. And it is somewhat sweet, depending on how you make it, but a thick, chunky mixture really good on a cracker.
Which is commonly called matzah, an unleavened bread. I'll start with mine. There are basically three ingredients in the Haroset from Marrakesh, Morocco. It's sweet wine. I'm using manischewitz, walnut, and dates. And I've prepared a mixture that has been pureed.
You're going to actually make it or are you going to just
No,
it
it's
out?
Already been made. Okay. I'm just showing you the pre-wine version of this. You can see it was pureed in the Cuisinart. It just kind of looks like what? Crumbs.
This bowl here has the chopped dates, the chopped nuts, and not the wine.
And so I'll mix that up. You can see how it is binding together.
Super, simple. Super simple.
Yes, very simple. There are four other recipes I have in the Sephardic cookbook. A Turkish haroset, it's cooked. There's an uncooked Turkish haroset. Greek from Rhodes. Moroccan from Marrakesh, which is what I'm making. Moroccan haroset from Tutuna. And Egyptian haroset. And most of these have apples, pitted dates, almonds, vinegar, wine, cinnamon. Much like what Robin is making, but mine is what I grew up with. My mother was from Tiberias, Israel, but originally from Morocco. So she made this one, the pitted dates, walnuts, and sweet wine. And we, as children, called it mud. We didn't know it was even called haroset.
Well, let me see what Robin is doing over here.
The first thing I did was I took some walnuts and put them in the toaster oven because they just need to be lightly toasted. There's something about baking them that mellows the flavor out just a little bit. Then I'm going to take some apples. And what we like to do in my family is we like to get a variety of apples. We don't stick with just one kind of apple. But I like to make sure that they're nice. They don't have wax on them because we leave the skin on. Chop them up. So I think one of the best ways to explain this is that most Jews in America came from Eastern Europe. So most of our recipes are Eastern European recipes, which is why this haroset is something I think most of us are familiar with. And Judy's is so unique. The Eastern European Jews were the biggest wave of immigrants to America in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and certainly after World War II. So you just want to pulse it just a little bit. It's supposed to be kind of chunky, not apple saucy.
This is in preparation for Passover and for the Seder plate, but you eat this on a cracker. Do you eat this at any other time of year? Will you make this just spontaneously?
No, it has so many calories. I would, and it's too delicious and tempting to eat. So no.
Not often, but my kids really like it. And so sometimes they'll say, oh, can you just make a little bit, you know, and they like to put it in their school lunches. But it's more of a special holiday food like latkes are for Hanukkah.
All right. Got my apples chopped.
Your walnuts are coming up.
My walnuts are coming up. So this is where not having a recipe comes into play, because what you do is you take your walnuts now and you just eyeball it. Some people like equal ratios. Just depends on what your family likes. All right. So then we'll just pour that in there. Oh. We've got a Central Coast Zinfandel, and it's really lovely. You judge how much you're using by the color. And if you have kids, I always make a version with just grape juice for the kids, because you don't cook the wine out, so eat too much of this and you'll feel it. I like to grate a little bit of whole nutmeg on there. All right, so you just grate. And can you smell? All right, and that's it. I mean, that's how easy it is. And you can taste it. And if
so, that's done.
That's done.
But that's not like mud or clay.
No, it isn't. It's completely different from the Sephardic type of charoset. It's okay. Very different. And so I didn't even know about Sephardic charoset until I was almost an adult.
And so I didn't know about yours until I was an adult.
So shall we try these delectables?
You know, there's a couple ways you can try them. You can just put them straight on the matzah. Or what my family likes to do is make something called a halal sandwich.
Okay, well, let's start with the matzah.
Okay.
We'll try each one on the matzah.
Okay. Here's the Sephardic charoset.
Okay.
And you may put some on the matzah, and as much as you want or as little as you think you can handle.
Three simple ingredients. Mm-hmm. That's very nice.
You like it, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As somebody who's not Jewish and isn't celebrating Passover, I could see this being a condiment for a cheese platter. Very nice.
One thing you should know, this keeps forever.
I'd imagine.
In the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now that you've brought that up, I think I will keep it in the refrigerator and add it to a cheese platter. What a great idea. Mm. Thank you.
See, you learned something new.
Now I'll make it throughout the year again.
That's right. Why my show is called Playing with Food.
Okay.
So now we have the Ashkenazi.
Right.
And it's much more loose.
Right.
And it's a lighter color.
And it's chunkier.
Okay, here we go. The nutmeg is what I taste first. That's what happens when you grate nutmeg.
There's almost too much nutmeg in this one.
It's definitely not sweet. It's nice. I think this one would also be in a cheese platter. This would balance the really, really strong cheeses.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to hold a temple together.
No, this isn't. Or a pyramid.
Or a pyramid.
Nothing. Nothing like that. It's easy to make, and I encourage you to go home and try it yourself. Mm-hmm. Break out a nice bottle of wine and make yourself some charoset.
Yeah.
The wine might not end up in the charoset.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, there's plenty. You only use a half a cup of wine for all of this ingredient, for a pound of dates and 2 cups of walnuts. So plenty of wine to taste after that.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is the Sephardic charoset is the sobering charoset, whereas the Ashkenazi charoset is the... not so sobering charoset. On Passover, we eat a halal sandwich. Okay. So you take a piece of matzah, you put some horseradish on it, and then you put some, usually I do it with the Ashkenazi charoset, and then you put another piece of matzah on top and you eat it. They go together beautifully.
But I think because horseradish is so spicy, I might use the Sephardic because it's sweeter. It'll go down easier for me.
Okay, let me give this a try.
How much horseradish can you handle?
Oh, a lot. I love horseradish. Oh, you're making me the sandwich. Yeah, I'll try both.
There you go.
Here we go. Here, we're going to try the Ashkenazi one with a lot of horseradish. That is really nice, actually.
Good.
Okay, let me try one with the other. Mm. I'm not doing well with the matzah over here.
Nobody ever does. Don't feel bad.
Yeah, matzah is everywhere when you eat matzah. What do you think?
It's good. It's very different. It does cut through the horseradish more.
Yes, it does.
This one is more horseradish forward because it's a lighter condiment, and that one's heavier.
Now remember, by the time you would eat this during a Seder, you were at least 1 to 2 glasses in of wine.
That's right.
You know, sometimes you could be a little more liberal with your horseradish because you aren't thinking.
Do you know anybody who makes matzah?
I have tried. What have I tried? I thought about trying. I think I was starting to, and I realized it's really hard because it rises fast. even if you don't use yeast, flour will rise on its own. Mm-hmm. And so you have to really stand there and watch. And
It never occurred to me to make matzah ever in a million years. It was something I bought of, and I have made bread and I love to cook, but I was watching a cooking show and someone was making matzah and they put weights on the dough and cooked it with the weights on and then removed the weights and continued cooking it. And she had a stack, this chef, I forget her name, stack of matzah. They were not rectangular or square. They were just, you know, free form. It was interesting. I bet they were delicious.
Neither Judy nor Robin had ever made matzah, so I invited them over to my house to give it a try. We are now in my house because we decided that it would be exciting to make matzah. So that's what we're going to do today, right?
Yeah.
So Judy's with me. Robin couldn't be with me. We're going to make matzah, and then we're going to try it with cheese and crackers and haricot, right? Because we thought that was a good idea last time we talked. Yes. But you found out some more information about matzah?
I did. Matzah was the food of the Israelites, and they took it with them on their exodus. But because they had to leave so quickly, they didn't have time for it to leaven. And we eat it every Passover for 7 days. And so we will get started making matzah today. I've never made matzah. I've only purchased it. This was an adventure.
So we have some that's made from plain flour and one from Karashan wheat, which is one of those ancient grains. So it could have been one of the grains that they made it out of.
Absolutely.
And that's organic and grown locally, this Karashan wheat.
Oh.
So we have some salt and we have some water. That's it, flour, salt, and water.
And you're using kosher salt.
Sure. Wink, wink. Can't remember what the box says. Salt. And on the mixer, and it said add the water slowly. Get it the consistency of pizza dough, which it'll need a little bit more water, won't it?
That's it. No, I think that's good. It just needs more time.
Okay. You sure it doesn't need a little bit more water?
Well, let's stop it by feel. No, I think that's good.
You think that's good?
Feel it.
Oh, yeah. It's moist. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Okay, now you see the pizza dough consistency. It's balling up. See that?
Yeah.
It just needed more time. I think we're good.
You think we're good?
I think we are.
Okay.
Any more, it would get rubbery.
But we'll put it in the bowl, and then we'll do this other one really quickly. All this one might require more flour because it's...
You need more water.
More water because it's a different type of flour.
Yes.
Turn it on.
Okay, this does need a little more water.
You think?
It's already balling up.
There we go.
Yeah, let's slow it down a little bit.
Okay.
Let's check the moisture level.
How's that feel to you?
Going to be fine.
Okay. You said you'd never made this before, but you seem to be an expert.
Well, I bake quite a bit. I'm familiar with the consistency of dough. I make cookies too, and this is... And pizza dough and...
Well, let's move to the other room.
Okay.
One of the things I noticed is that they all have fork holes, and even though this recipe doesn't say that, the picture that accompanies the recipe has a little fork hole, so we each have a fork.
Either that or you have to put weights on it so it doesn't rise, because all flour has a rising component to it, and this is an unleavened bread. So either we put weights on it or we fork it.
Just roll it out. You've never done this. This sounds like something that you could do with your family.
I could have. I never even thought about it.
This is something you can talk about at synagogue next Friday.
Yes, I can.
You can start the matzah circle.
That's a great idea. I could make it with the school children, the religious school children.
Is that good enough?
I think so. Okay. Yes, and mine's small, but I'm going to leave it like that because I like the thickness of it.
Okay, this is very soft, this Karashan wheat one. I'm going to fork it.
So, let's just fork it. Make it easy. I don't know what weights you have available.
Cast iron pan.
Okay. All right.
Okay. How simple was that?
That was very simple.
Very simple. So we have to just make sure we don't burn
When you buy matzah in the store, they're square. And what we have made look like beautiful clouds. Different shapes with rounded corners. They're not rectangular at all.
Okay, so put them in the oven. I'll put mine on the bottom. Here's on the top. And it said like 3 minutes. It's on 500.
Wow.
and we just wait for 3 minutes.
Okay.
I am paranoid that it's gonna burn.
500 is very hot.
It's very hot, but you gotta trust the recipe.
On bake, it's 500. I don't think my oven goes to 500. Well, they look pretty good so far.
Okay, well, there's the timer. Let's see. Let's see what happens here. Let's see. It's going to take a little bit longer, I think, because it's a different type of flour. So it's not 100% crisp.
No, see, it's not done.
Okay, let's turn it over. Because one of the recipes said turn it over and put it back in.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, those look really good.
Oh, so these are the Karashan wheat ones.
Yeah, they made a really nice matzo.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, these are really good. I'm going to taste these.
Now, let's move them back to the dining room. They look good.
Yes, they look very good.
I don't think the white ones are going to be crispy.
The recipe called for 3 minutes.
For 3 minutes,
I think longer on the white for sure, but the others are very nice and crisp.
Do you want to snap it?
Sure.
It tears.
It tears. It doesn't snap. There might be another one that does snap, like that one.
Okay, try that one.
See, in the middle, there's still... Oh, that one a little better. So they clearly need more than 3 minutes.
Okay.
I'd say.
Okay.
This is a Sephardic harofet with the dates and walnuts and sweet wine. Here you are.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'm going to try it myself. I like the harofet. The matzah is a little chewy. You think?
I'm flexible on the matzah.
The edges are really crisp and they are very flavorful.
Yeah.
It has the right amount of salt. I think a little more cooking would be good.
And these are the Karashan wheat ones, right?
Mm-hmm,
and you're going to try your harofet with the blue cheese.
Okay.
These are California cheeses. One is local and two are Sonoma County. So how is it with the blue cheese? So have I reinvented harofet for you? Because you've heard of eating it with cheese before.
Mm-mm. Delicious.
But we need to try it with wine, of course.
Of course.
This is a Riesling. Okay, so which one are you going to try now?
Okay, I think I'll try the cheddar. And I'm going to try the white flour matzo.
And to be fair to Robin, even though she's not here, we should try it with the other one as well.
Yes, I'll try the Ashkenazi with the apples.
Okay.
And the nutmeg walnuts.
Very nice. And with the Riesling? I've just redone Passover for you.
Yes, you have.
What a great combination. Mm-hmm. So, your assessment of matzah making, is this something that you're going to do again?
No. This was very enjoyable. It's too easy to go to the store and buy crisp matzah. I will do it with my grandchildren and the school children, but, you know, making it for the Passover meal, probably not.
Come Passover, you can make a double batch of your harofet. You can get with the school children and make some matzah crackers. And then for the entire month of May, you can just sit out on the back porch with your wine and your extra leftover harofet and your leftover matzah and have a nice time with your husband.
Yes.
How's that sound?
It sounds wonderful. L'chaim.
Our Playing with Food was preparing for Passover. Within their own faith, there was a cultural exchange between Ashkenazi and Sephardic, and we discovered a new way to eat and share haroset and matzah. That's why I love Playing with Food. I'm Father Ian. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio.
Been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Issues and Ideas will be on break next week and will be airing a special program instead next Monday at 1 in the afternoon. But to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments, it's all at kcbx.org.